Thank you, Susan. This is Saturday with Justin McCarthy. You're very welcome to the programme. On our panel today, Minister for Justice Charlie Flanagan, Fianna Fáil TD Niall Collins, Sinn Féin's David Cullinan, political commentator Patricia McBride, and Irish Examiner political correspondent Daniel McConnell. Today marks the end of an era. It's a special Ordesh in Dublin, just down the road from us, where Sinn Féin will change its leader for the first time in almost 35 years. Mary Lou MacDonald will take over from Gerry Adams, who's led the party since 1983. Now, I know, David Cullinan, that you've just come from the RDS to be with us. And Minister Charlie Flanagan, you've sat across from Gerry Adams on a number of occasions as a negotiator, particularly in, I think, the Stormont House Agreement and the Fresh Start Agreement. So we'll get your takes on Gerry Adams in a couple of minutes' time. But first, I want to go to the phone to talk to another person who will have a perspective on Gerry Adams as a negotiator, and that's former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. Bertie Ahern, thanks for taking our call this afternoon. I was reading a piece during the week written by the journalist Eamon Malley, who said that there are several Gerry Adamses and nobody really knows the real one. What's your own experience of him?
Well, I met Gerry about 30 years ago when he was canvassing for the only councillor that Sinn Féin used to have in Dublin. In the whole of City and County Dublin those days, Christy Burke. And I suppose it was around the time of the first ceasefire that I started working with him and working on behalf of the government. I was finance minister then. And all the way up till I finished, I was negotiating with him and dealing with him. And so I wasn't in, I don't have a perspective other than we read about him in the years of the Troubles. I have many spats with him about whether he was involved in the IRA or not, but I think that argument has been well run, and we all have our own views on it. But as a negotiator and as a person, him and Martin McGuinness, I dealt with all the way. We had lots of ups and downs. We had the great success of the first ceasefire with Albert Reynolds in 94, and then we had all the difficulties about starting the talks. Then the ceasefire broke down in February 96. Then we had a very difficult 18-month period where effectively all political parties broke off contact with Sinn Féin. And then when I was elected, we resumed that contact to get the ceasefire up. And all the way through from 97 to 2007, I don't think there was a week, maybe not a day, that I wasn't in touch with either Martin McGuinness or Gerry Adams negotiating to get the institutions up, and then they'd collapse and get them up again. So, you know, in that time, we had lots of rows, lots of arguments, lots of differences. But on a personal level, I got on well with him. We were able to talk civilly to each other. He could be a strappy guy, you know, as negotiators go. He would change his position often, which Martin used to, that used to annoy me, but my game was to keep it quiet and keep it calm and try and keep things going and try and work collectively to get peace on this island and peace in Northern Ireland in particular.
And what were the personal characteristics that he had that maybe allowed him to bring the hardliners in his party with him down the road eventually towards peace?
Well, I think that was his big success, in fairness to him. I mean, I think he had to come in negotiating and arguing the case, not only of Sinn Féin, but there's a detail that's often forgotten now, even in some books you read them back and you say, God, where did these guys get their facts? But sometimes, Justin, it's forgotten that when George Mitchell went around the table on Good Friday and asked people to agree to the Good Friday Agreement, Sinn Féin couldn't. They stayed silent and said they would come back. And, of course, they weren't going back to have a Sinn Féin conference as they are today. They were going back to talk to the IRA. And, you know, so he always had to do that. And I know they were criticised for all that they had to do is look into the mirror. But I think that's an unfair thing. They had to go out and deal with the various units, the Northern Union, the various units, and to win support and carry them with them. And I had that conversation with them many times. And that wasn't easy. And I know that Gerry always wanted to carry the vast, vast and overwhelming majority of IRA volunteers into the peace process. And I think they succeeded in doing that. They didn't get everybody, but they got the vast majority.
You mentioned there the denials, the persistent denials that he was a member of the IRA. Was that something that troubled you at all, that, you know, that he never fully acknowledged that past?
Yeah, well, you know, I think we had a good few arguments in the Dáil and publicly about that over the years. But listen, you know, there's no point. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, Gerry was in the IRA. Gerry was at the heart of the IRA leadership. What days he came in and what days he went out, I've no idea. But I can understand, I think, why he didn't. I think he was associated with things that if he had have owned up, two, it would have made him very difficult, different for him to deal with unionists. So he felt that was a different position to Martin's. Now, I never agree with that. I don't want to be saying I agree with it now, because I don't. But I think that was from his perspective. So I suppose after all these years, we leave it at that. But yeah, as far as I'm concerned, Gerry Adams was at the heart of the Northern Brigade of the IRA.
I remember some time ago reading that you had to defend Gerry Adams to President George W. Bush in Washington. Do you remember? Do you remember what happened there?
I do very well. It was 2005. It was St. Patrick's Day 2005. It was after the Northern Bank raid at Christmas 2004. It was after the McCartney. The murder of Robert McCartney, and we were involved in bringing the sisters over to Robert McCartney's sisters over to Washington for St. Patrick's Day, and the George Bush's view was, and the State Department's view was, that, you know, these were a bunch of terrorists, and they didn't want them in the White House, and they didn't want them there. But, you know, Tony Blair and I had met in January, and we had said we wanted to try and, you know, keep this going, keep the thing together. You know, that's what it was about. Of course, Gerry was blaming us and blaming me at the time for trying to undermine the peace process and criminalise the Sinn Féin. You know, we had a lot of reasons to have rows at that stage, and it was a very difficult few months. But I did fight the cause of Sinn Féin, because I believed that putting them outside was the wrong thing to do, and it was better to address it. And of course, that's what led to John McCain speaking at the Ireland Fund dinner and lambasting Gerry and Sinn Féin for. Well, he went very strong with them that night. I think he called them a bunch of cowards. But we wanted everybody there so that we could try and keep things together and get things moving again.
And finally, Bertie Ahern, before I let you go, a word on Mary Lou MacDonald, who takes over from him today. She's obviously in the same constituency as you stood yourself. What difference do you think she'll make? And potentially, could she be a threat to Fianna Fáil, maybe, when she takes over as leader?
Well, God knows, but I know Mary Lou very well. She's a very good person. She's a very good worker. I know her for many, many years. And, you know, she lives in the heart of the constituency, not far from me. I think she's many challenges. And I think it's as simple or as complicated as this. She has to hold her 15%+ and hold that Sinn Féin base, but equally has to look for new ground. I think she has to look at the areas of the economy and Europe and things that Sinn Féin have been fairly poor on over the years and under Gerry's leadership. And I think if she's to build new ground, it is in these new areas, in the social policy areas, but particularly the economy, particularly Europe, where Sinn Féin have been weak or against, and now we're into a different. And she can win more support if she does that, and women's issues. But if, you know, it's not going to be easy to hold anyone leading a political party. You have to hold one side that you've always had, and you have to build new ones. So, you know, there's always the danger of alienation, and that's not going to be easy.
All right. Listen, former Taoiseach Bertie Ahern, thank you very much for taking our call and for those insights this afternoon. Minister Charlie Flanagan, you also sat across the negotiating table from Gerry Adams. Was he the master strategist that he is painted to be?
Well, my experience with Gerry Adams stems from the Stormont House Agreement in 14 and 10 weeks of the Fresh Start Agreement the following year. I always found him around the table. I found him courteous, but he was cold, he was clinical, strictly disciplined. But I was really mindful, and I think it's important in the context of today's proceedings, that we look at Gerry Adams over the last 35 years and not merely Gerry Adams the politician. And I lived through the Troubles, and we really have got to acknowledge the mayhem, the death, the destruction, deaths of 3,000 people, the vast majority of whom died at the hands of the Republican movement. And I think we've got to confront now what we can describe as the big lie, reading Anthony McIntyre, close associate, former close associate of Gerry Adams, yesterday's Irish Times, you know, quite clear that Adams has refused to accept right throughout his career association or membership with the IRA. And, you know, that is the big lie that needs to be confronted.
But why did he do that, though? Because I remember watching an interview that Eamon Malley did with Martin McGuinness, and he asked Martin McGuinness this question: why did Gerry Adams persistently refuse? Martin McGuinness said that he himself had immunity from prosecution under the Bloody Sunday Tribunal terms, but that Gerry Adams wouldn't have had that.
Well, history is judging these issues. I think this morning of Tom Oliver and his family. I think of the Stack family in my own constituency, in my own town. I think of Paul Quinn. I think of Jean McConville and the many disappeared. I think of the Troubles across the two islands, Ireland and Britain, and responsibility with Gerry Adams for much of that pretty unacceptable period of Irish history. And I see now attempts by Sinn Féin currently to rewrite the history of the civil rights movement. You know, which really had very, very little to do with Sinn Féin. And I see the tribalisation and the balkanisation of politics in Northern Ireland. And I think there has been no more a divisive figure in Irish politics over the last 40 years than Gerry Adams. We're totally stepping down today, but to quote himself, you know, I wonder, is he going away, you know?
There was a similarly negative critique offered by your party leader, Niall Collins, during the week, Micheál Martin. But doesn't that negative critique overlook the fact that Gerry Adams has a significant achievement in bringing the men of violence down the road towards peace?
There's no doubt what was outlined by Bertie Hearn in his earlier contribution, that Gerry Adams played a role in the peace process. But exactly what Charlie Flanagan has just said here, there's an agenda out there to try and rewrite Gerry Adams's wider role over the years in this country. And, you know, when I think of Gerry Adams, I see an apologist for the IRA. I recall a number of years ago down in Limerick, Gerry Adams denying that the IRA had anything to do with the killing of Garda Gerry McCabe. And there are numerous examples. And if you step it forward then into the more present day, look at the whole issue around Maria Cahill, for example, as Charlie Flanagan also said, Paul Quinn. You know, there are many, many, you know, real live issues out there. There are widows out there. And I would agree with what I read in the Irish Times in the last number of days, where Seamus Mallon basically pointed out to what we now have is a complete polarisation in the north of Ireland. And we had the cynical collapsing of the Stormont executive before Christmas by Sinn Féin. And let's call it what it was. It was a cheap electoral stunt where they tried to wipe out the SDLP in one stroke, which basically backfired. And they have abandoned the people of Northern Ireland at a very crucial time when Brexit is knocking on the door.
Patricia McBride, I suppose Gerry Adams confuses an awful lot of people because there are many dimensions to him and many sides to his political career. But I suppose there is that dark shadow as well in his past. I'm thinking particularly of the Jean McConville murder, things like that, that he has always struggled to get away from.
Well, that's true, but you know, that spectre has always haunted him. But it's quite startling to sort of hear the two previous speakers talk about as if everything that has happened during the conflict was the fault of Gerry Adams. The reality of the situation is, if the PSNI had any evidence that Gerry Adams was guilty of anything, or the RUC before them, then he would have been hauled before courts long before now. So, you know, we have to afford him the respect that the rule of law has, you know, that everyone else is subjected to, is Gerry Adams is subject to as well. So if there's any evidence, bring it forth and prosecute him. That's my response to that. Now,
of course, he was in Port Leisure for some time.
But he hasn't been prosecuted. Has he been prosecuted in respect of Jean McConville? No, he hasn't. He was questioned. He was brought in. The Director of Public Prosecution said there is no file being prepared. So that's gone. You can't hold that. You know, we can't continue to harp back to that. What we need to do now is look at, you know, for me, I want to look at some of the positives that I think has happened. And one of the biggest positives in respect of Adams's political career was the Hume Adams initiative that started in 1993, because that was the foundation for the peace process that we see now. And albeit that it is still a process, we are not a post-conflict society, we're still a transitional society. But it was the final phase of that. And I think that there was a huge amount of courage there shown by both John Hume and Gerry Adams in starting that initiative and having that dialogue within nationalism, because it created a set of conditions for the IRA ceasefire. It created an impetus for the British and Irish governments to come together to frame the Downing Street Declaration, where the British very clearly articulated that there was no selfish strategic or political interest in maintaining their presence in the North. But I think what more importantly that initiative did was it set out the context in terms of the rights of the Irish people for self-determination within the framework of what we now know in the Good Friday Agreement as the principle of consent. Okay. And that was a sea change for physical force republicanism to accept that it wasn't about forcing people into a united Ireland. It was about saying, let's create the conditions where a united Ireland can come about by consent. So I think that that's one of the things that Adams and John Hume working together can be credited very greatly with.
Okay, I want to come to David Cullinan. You've been listening to the various critiques of Gerry Adams there. His involvement with people who were violent, his justification of violence, isn't that something that has hampered the growth of Sinn Féin particularly over the last number of years?
No, because the facts speak for themselves. If you look at the last 20 years, when I joined Sinn Féin, we had one TD in Leinster House. We now have 23. We had one MP in the North. We now have 7. We had a couple of handful of councillors across this state. And but we now have over 150. The electoral performances of Sinn Féin under Gerry Adams has shown the party has grown massively. If I can just deal with the narrative that was painted by Niall and Charlie.
Just on that point first, before you move on to that, there was a survey in the Irish Times done which said a fifth of voters were more likely to back Sinn Féin with Mary Lou MacDonald as leader. Doesn't that underline the point that Gerry Adams stunted Sinn Féin's electoral growth?
I don't believe it did, and obviously we want to build and continue to grow, and whether it's under Mary Lou or anybody else, we'll always try and grow the party. But I just want to come back to the narrative that was set by Niall and by Charlie. They completely missed the fact that there was a context to the conflict in the North, and there was reasons why people joined the IRA. And Sinn Féin is not about rewriting history, because I'm an Irish Republican and I will defend the right of Martin McGuinness and many people like him and their rationale for joining the IRA. I'm not going to apologise for everything that the IRA did, nor will I condone everything the IRA did. There was many things the IRA did that were wrong. There was a lot of murders and a lot of killings I don't agree with. A lot of terrible things were done in the course of a conflict. But equally, there was a lot of wrong on the British side, unionist paramilitaries and so on. So there was a context, and there was reasons why young people were motivated to join the IRA. And we're not in the business of rewriting the civil rights movement, because that stands in its own right. But it was met with brutal force by a sectarian orange state. And that's the reason why that collapsed. And it's one of the reasons why many young men and women at the time joined the IRA. And Gerry Adams has never dodged his responsibilities in terms of being a Republican leader. Never.
But he has always justified violence, hasn't he?
He has justified, as I would, a person's right to defend themselves and their communities and their families. I mean, if you're asking me, do I condemn Martin McGuinness for joining the IRA? No, I will never condemn Martin McGuinness and people like him for joining the IRA. If you're asking me, do I agree with everything that the IRA did? Of course I don't. We all know that war is ugly and war is brutal and people are killed in war. And right through all of that conflict, people like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness were always, and others outside of Sinn Féin, were looking for alternatives, looking to try and create political alternatives so that we could bring an end to violence. And bear in mind, we've had many Republican leaders for hundreds of years on this island, and Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness as a combined leadership are the people who took almost now all of the guns out of Irish politics. That's a massive achievement. They didn't do it on their own. There was others outside of Sinn Féin. It was a collective effort by many people, but they played a very central part in that. So we're not going to rewrite history, Niall, or Charlie. I stand here as an Irish Republican who completely understands the reason why people in the North joined the IRA. And while many people from your party, Charlie, and from Fianna Fáil washed their hands of what was happening in the North, we had people who had no choice, as far as they saw it, to fight back against what they saw as an orange state. And maybe sometime Charlie and others might come into the studio with lists of names of people who were killed by the British Army, loyalist paramilitaries, and stop using victims of Republican violence as pawns to attack Sinn Féin. What we want is to support all victims through processes that are part of discussions at the moment to get the institutions in the North up and running again.
All right, I want to give the Minister a chance to respond to that.
Charlie has done
it. I'm merely commenting on the facts as we discuss, as we've been asked to do, the legacy of Gerry Adams. And can I say, as Minister for Justice, that the greatest threat to the security of our state today, having regard to the international terrorism, jihadists, all this reprehensible business worldwide, the greatest threat to the stability and security of our state comes from dissident Republicans along the border area. Now, would they be active? Would they be involved in criminality and terrorism if it weren't for the legacy of the Troubles and Sinn Féin IRA through the years? This is still a work of progress, and listening to Bertie Ahern, when he was asked about the priorities for the new leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, I would give her one priority, and I would say to her that what she needs to do as a matter of urgency is to work towards the restoration, urgently and importantly, of the Northern Executive now, over a year since we had any work done in Northern Ireland. Real problems of Brexit, no seats in Westminster, and we see Sinn Féin opting out for cynical political means on a daily basis, and we're hearing more of it.
Can I just respond to that very quickly? No, because a number of charges have been made about the institutions in the North and that Sinn Féin was playing games in terms of bringing down the institutions. Martin McGuinness served for 10 years in a power-sharing administration, a number of them with a number of different unionist leaders. And he called time on what he saw as the DUP at the time not implementing the decisions that were made and agreements that were made. We had the RHI scandal and the disrespect that was being shown to the nationalist community. And he said no return to the status quo. So far from people being polarised, the nationalist people who vote for Sinn Féin in the North are ordinary, decent people, and their rights to vote for who they want for should be respected. What we want is to be in government with partners who will deliver on commitments that were made. And I can just say this to Charlie and to others. If they can point to anywhere in the peace process or any of the agreements from the Good Friday Agreement, the St Andrews Agreement, Stormont House Fresh Start, if they can point to even one area where Sinn Féin and Republicans gave a commitment, we delivered on every single one without question.
All right.
Others have not, okay, including the Irish government on legacy issues and the British government.
Before Stormont collapsed, did Sinn Féin and the DUP, you were recruiting spin doctors, you were recruiting a PR office to sell what you were doing in government, in the executive at the time.
I don't name that PR offer.
That's on the record. You were working together and you conjured up this bogeyman about the cash for Ash scheme, the RHI scandal. Your own ministers were out there selling it. It was a cynical attempt to try and gain an electoral advantage, which you've been doing for years, all the way through the peace process, where you've been using the proceeds
of illegal activity, bank raids, laundering of goods up and down the border. Nobody's going to hear everyone talking over each other.
Patricia McBride.
The reality of the situation in the North is that you have five main political parties, four of whom are united in their opposition to the DUP's position on marriage equality, to the DUP's position on a lack of reproductive rights for women, and three, Sinn Féin, the Green Party, the Alliance Party and the SDLP, all support an Irish Language Act, as does the Irish government. So it's not Sinn Féin collapsing the institutions, it's a greater movement within politics in the North. When you look at the fact that the last time there was an assembly up and running, there was an opposition, that was a failed experiment. And I think both the Ulster Unionist Party and the SDLP have seen that and are now trying to create the conditions where, when the assembly institutions are back up and running, that it is a true assembly partnership, that it is a true executive partnership. And I think that we've seen that this week. What I would like to see happening in the course of the negotiations next week, at the start of the week, is that those parties are actually all around the table together. The DUP and Sinn Féin are not sitting in bilateral talks or sitting in talks with the governments without the other parties, because this has to be a coalition of the willing. It has to be people who are willing to make the institutions work, and the goodwill is there. But there's also the anger is still there. And until the rights-based issues are addressed, people are not going to want to go back into a position where the DUP can use their electoral strength to walk away from promoting and protecting rights.
So that's obviously something that the new party leader, Mary Lou MacDonald, is going to have to deal with. And among the other difficulties that she faces, I suppose, is growing her own party's base in the Republic, preparing for government, perhaps, and dealing then with the allegations of bullying and intimidation within her own party. And Daniel McConnell, your newspaper catalogued those allegations of bullying during the week. I think at least 15 people who have quit Sinn Féin alleging intimidation and bullying of some sort. How big a problem is that for Mary Lou MacDonald as she takes over the leadership?
Yeah, I suppose while not every case is exactly the same, and there are remarkable similarities among a number of them. And I think, you know, what we were getting when these cases first emerging were this is a localised, isolated incident. Now, there are far too many localised, isolated incidents now for them not to be seen as a trend or something that's more symptomatic of what's going on within the party. I've often described it as these are the growing pains, the culture of old and new within Sinn Féin, and clearly there are tensions as they are in every political party. You know, the inter-constituency rivalries happen all over the place. The nature of, I suppose, the repetition of, you know phrases like hostile atmosphere, aggression, you know, bullying, so on and so forth. These are not typical from other parties that we see, and the litany of them and the concentration of so many cases in the last few years alone is somewhat alarming. She has to get to grips with this, and she has already herself, I think, in commentary before Christmas said there is an issue that needs to be addressed. But I am also of the view that if Sinn Féin are really to make inroads in terms of Middle Ireland and, you know, to kind of attack the sort of bases that previously were occupied by the Labour Party and somewhat occupied now by Fianna Fáil, they need to stamp out this and also become a credible voice for, you know, working class people in Ireland and for middle class people who are probably more willing to look at Mary Lou as a credible candidate.
But you say it's to do with the tensions between the old guard and the new guard. What are those tensions? I mean, is it the case that maybe some of the newer recruits are expecting a more traditional political party with the structures of a traditional political party, or what is it?
They want to be treated like a normal political party, and there are many things about Sinn Féin that aren't in keeping with a normal political party. I know David's going to be, you know, probably shaking his head here in a minute and disagreeing with me, but I mean, I've been writing on politics for well over a decade now. Sinn Féin don't operate like all other political parties do in terms of how they, you know, not only their media strategy, how they appoint, not elect people, how they appoint and nominate people to key positions. And also as well, I just think ultimately what you're seeing is people who don't come and were not involved in the conflict or the struggle, as they call it, are Democrats in their own view and of a newer generation, and generally want to see things done in a proper, transparent and accountable way. But we don't get that. And often what you see is, as we saw in one example in Dublin in the last week or so, that clash between old and new.
David Cullinan, does Sinn Féin have a problem with bullying?
No, absolutely not.
And 15 to 20 cases.
I was trying to answer the question. You're going to ask a question, allow me to answer the question. I've been involved in Sinn Féin for 20 years. I've never experienced anybody being bullied. I've never seen anybody being bullied. I've never been bullied, and I certainly wouldn't bully anybody. And I would have absolutely no truck with anybody that would engage in those type of activities. There has been a small number of claims of bullying. There has been other issues which were the local disputes that you talked about. We have some people, as in any organisation with 13,000 members and hundreds of elected representatives, sometimes, surprise, surprise, in an organisation, people don't get on.
But can you point to another political party where we've had 15 to 20 cases in the last number of years of people resigning because they say that they were intimidated or bullied or harassed?
Well, obviously, if anybody resigns from the party, I don't like that. We want to keep everybody on board. But equally, in the most recent example, a claim was made by a female councillor in Dublin that she was being bullied.
We're not going to go into the specifics because we don't know, and we're not going to try. Daniel raised the most recent example in Dublin.
What I'm saying is, an allegation was made. The party dealt with it, and I think if the party was guilty of anything, it was not coming to conclusions maybe much earlier. And in terms of Sinn Féin being different to other parties, I'm glad that Daniel has acknowledged that Sinn Féin is different from Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. We're different for all sorts of different reasons, but we are a democratic party. Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, when they were in government, will appoint ministers. The ministers are not elected by their membership, they're appointed. We're the only party, in fact, where the membership will elect our leader. If you look at the most recent leadership contest in Fine Gael, the person who won the membership is not the leader of Fine Gael and not the Taoiseach.
Well,
so
at least it was
people
a contest, though, Dave. At least there was a contest.
Well, where, obviously, you know, that's...
But there's loads of... I mean, Bertie Ahern was elected unopposed. Brendan Howland was elected unopposed. Gard Fitzgerald in the past was elected unopposed. Sometimes that happens because she wasn't elected to any position. There is now
She's the leader of the party
she
in the
was
North.
She was going to be the person who was going to be the Deputy First Minister in the North. There is now a contest for the leader and deputy leader. But just on one final point on Mary Lou.
Give me a break.
I'm not here to give you a break, Daniel. And if Mary Lou MacDonald is the best candidate for the leadership, why would somebody go up against her for the sake of it?
Well, why not?
Why
did Matt Carthy then put his name in for the deputy position and then all of a sudden 24 hours say, oh no, I'm not going to do it? Why? Because he was probably lent on by party
So you're speculating now.
I'm not speculating. I'm just reading. I'm analysing because that's my job. Well, I analyse and commentate.
What I'm saying is that Mary Lou
MacDonald, why would Matt Carthy put his name in and then say all of a sudden, saying he has the numbers, then to withdraw?
Matt Carthy can speak for himself. But yeah. Mary Lou MacDonald, in my view, is head and shoulders above everybody.
I want to go to Niall Collins. Can I ask you this question? Mm-hmm. Are Fianna Fáil worried about Mary Lou MacDonald taking over the leadership of Sinn Féin? Because you won't now be able to ask Mary Lou MacDonald about IRA membership, about associations with a violent past, or any of those questions, because they're not there to be asked. Is there, and that survey we saw from the Irish Times showing that 20% of people more likely to vote for Sinn Féin under a Mary Lou MacDonald leadership.
And that will remain to be seen. The straight answer is no. I suppose we could point to Mary Lou MacDonald and ask her about the 2015 PSNI MI5 report, which pointed to the continued role of the IRA in directing Sinn Féin. We could point to Mary Lou's failure to address any of the legacy issues like Brian Stack, Paul Quinn, there's many of them there to mention, her stance on Maria Cahill, her complete failure to deal with any of the bullying cases that we've had. Almost one-eighth of their councillors have resigned due to bullying allegations, and Mary Lou has sung dumb. Only a few months ago, or a few years ago, a few short years ago, during the last Dáil, Mary Lou came in and blatantly abused Dáil privilege. That's a matter of public record. She was found to have abused it. She says she stands up for fairness, equality, people's rights. She went into the Dáil and tried to trash a whole number of individuals, characters under the veil of Dáil privilege. You know, so that's the Mary Lou in the here and now. So do we fear Mary Lou?
The answer is yes,
course,
obviously.
No, of course we don't. We're pointing out, David, to the listeners
the
and
yes,
to people
worried.
Who are thinking of voting for Mary Lou, this is what she stands for. And if you look at the policy platform, you're anti-Europe, you have a whole policy platform which people will not connect with.
Last,
time will tell.
Last word before the break to Minister Charlie Flanagan. On Mary Lou MacDonald, I mean, does her election to the leadership of Sinn Féin make Sinn Féin a more attractive partner or prospective partner for a future government with one of the bigger parties, maybe Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael?
I don't believe it does for a whole host of reasons. Economic policies that I see David week after week after week getting up in the Dáil and offering the checkbook solution to everything in the Irish economy, Irish society. We won't have time to go into that now, but we will have an opportunity to prosecute Sinn Féin economic policies. I think a lot more work needs to be done in terms of moving away from shadowy figures north of the border when dealing with the power base of Sinn Féin. But I want to end this section on a positive note, and I know Patricia beside me when referring to the Northern Executive and the current talks, she used the word when rather than if. I think that's positive, and I would wish everybody well next week, and I would wish Mary Lou MacDonald well in ensuring that her priority must be to do everything in her power to ensure that we have a functioning Northern Executive, and both Taoiseach Varadkar and Minister Coveney will ensure that the Irish government plays its part, because it's vital that there be a voice for Northern Ireland now with all the difficulties we have, not least the matter of the withdrawal of the UK from the European Union.
All right, that's a functioning Northern Executive. That's the hope. We'll be talking about whether we've a functioning Dáil after this break. Welcome back to Saturday with Justin McCarthy. Now, there were rowdy scenes in the Dáil this week over speaking time. You'll no doubt have heard about it or seen it online. Now, in case you didn't know who was involved, it was Fianna Fáil's Mark McSharry on one side, Michael and Danny Healy-Rae on the other side, and Michael Healy-Rae is on the line now. Michael, good afternoon. The clip of your row with Mark McSharry in the Dáil, it went round the world. Some people saying it was embarrassing. Do you regret it at all?
Well, I suppose, Justin, how could I regret it when I had absolutely nothing to do with it? I was perfectly within order. I was standing up. I was speaking on behalf of an issue that was very important to farmers in my area. And another member took it upon himself to heckle me and to try to stop me. Now, how you could honestly ask me on your programme and ask me had I any regret about the behaviour of somebody else? Well, it's sort of an odd question, Justin.
Did you have any contact from Mark McSharry afterwards? I understand he may have passed you a note, is that correct?
Well, he did, to be honest. He did, but I wouldn't divulge the contents that he gave me a three-page letter. And but
a three-page letter?
Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, what did he say? Did he criticise you or...?
No, I mean, I'd say that at this stage maybe he realises that what he did was wrong. But look, I'm not going to be saying what was on the letter that a man wrote to me. But Allah, you asked me the question, did he contact me? Yes, he did. I have to be honest and tell you that yes, he did. But I believe he was completely out of order. And the proof of that was when the Dáil resumed, without I indicating, without I saying anything, the last Kyung caller, who is an excellent and fair man, as is the Kyung caller himself, and each Kahirlik that we have who also take over the running of the chamber, I find them all to be extremely fair. We'd all like to get more speaking time if we could. But without I indicating, when the Dáil resumed, the last Kyung caller called on me first. That meant I actually was in position when I was continuously interrupted by another person.
Okay.
And when you were talking about me having regrets, you were aiming that question at the wrong politician.
And all of this stems from this new procedure around speaking time in the Dáil, where you have to take a numbered card and take your place in the queue. Is that system now going to be changed as a result of what happened last week?
I'd say no, that the people that thought that system was a good idea have a bad fright got. And I think we might be seeing the end of that system, because, to be honest with you, it was a load of rubbish anyway. I mean, it's not playing bingo. We're there to speak up for our constituents. We're there to be treated fairly. And this thing of having to queue up and get numbers, the system that was there worked for decades, and it worked fairly and adequately, whether people were independents or whether they were in a political grouping or a technical group. And I think that the whips will have to sit down and perhaps, it's not for me to be telling them what to do, but I know that our own whip, who's very excellent at his job, Matty McGrath, I know that he is not happy with this system, and he had already objected to it at whips meetings and made his and our group's views well known.
Okay, but there seems to be some annoyance, Michael Healy-Ray, that yourself and your brother Danny get more speaking time than a lot of backbench TDs from the bigger parties, and that you constantly use that time to raise local rather than national issues. Is that a point?
No, it's not a point, Justin, and I'm very surprised at you to be as good as looking down your nose at local issues.
I'm not.
Well, can I put it to you this way? If I'm standing up and if I'm talking about post offices, am I talking about post offices in County Kerry or in Ireland? There are post offices, you know, in the rest of the country as well as in County Kerry. So many local issues are national issues. If I'm talking about farmers not being paid their gas payments, there are farmers throughout the country, not just in County Kerry, who haven't received their GLAS payments. So to be a national politician, you have to be elected locally. Many of the local issues that we have are national issues also. And many presenters, like yourself, fail to recognise that fact.
Okay. All right. Michael, I'm going to let you go there, and thank you very much for taking the call. David Cullinan, I know you have to leave us now to go back down to the Sinn Féin special, Ardesh, but just on that point about the procedures in the Dáil, would you like to see the system or the rules change? This numbered card system, it seems to be annoying a lot of people.
Listen, I think if the people listening to the programme are concerning themselves with card systems in the Dáil, I think we've completely lost it. The majority of people listening to this programme will be more concerned about what politicians do and not what they say in the Dáil and voting arrangements and card systems. It's an idea that was brought in to make sure there was fairness in terms of when people got in for one segment in the Dáil. There was a row. There is rows in the Dáil, but I think the vast majority of people will be more concerned about what politicians do and what they deliver or not deliver on, and not whether they get speaking time or not in the Dáil.
Okay, and just briefly before I let you go and before we take a break, we're going to be talking after the break about those comments that Michel Barnier made yesterday in relation to Brexit. And he said the UK's decision to quit the customs union and the single market mean that Irish border checks are unavoidable. Also saying that a transition agreement, something that Britain really wants, is not a done deal. What's your view of those remarks?
Well, first of all, it's hard to understand what exactly is the position of Downing Street at the moment, and that's the problem. We're in phase two, where there is now discussions ongoing between the British government and the European Union on their future relationship in terms of trade with the European Union. My preference would be that Britain would stay in the customs union and single market. That's the best price that we can get. Our concern, of course, is that if the hard Brexiteers get the upper hand and if Britain does come out of the customs union and single market and they drag the North out against the will of the people, that obviously will mean a hardening of the border. No backstop agreement that was made and having alignment in some areas is going to then avoid a hardening of the border. So obviously we would be concerned. We want the Irish government to succeed and the European Union to succeed in terms of their negotiations. I would agree with the analysis from Mr. Barnier that if Britain comes out of the customs union and single market, that's a difficulty, because you have to police the rules of the customs union and single market. But it's in all of these, as we know, in all negotiations, people say an awful lot. I think what we are trying to understand is where in the final analysis the British government will end up. And I hope they will end up in a more sensible position, which is as close alignment with the rules of the customs union and single market as possible. That's the best outcome for Ireland.
All right. We wish you a good trip back down to the RDS and to your party today. We'll take a break now and we'll talk more about those comments after this break. Welcome back to Saturday with Justin McCarthy. Now, before the break there, we were talking about those comments yesterday from the EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, who said that the UK decision to quit the customs union and the single market would mean that Irish border checks, or border checks indeed, would be unavoidable. Minister Charlie Flanagan, in December, the government announced that it had a deal which guaranteed that there would be no hard border with Northern Ireland. The Taoiseach at the time saying that was a bulletproof deal, a cast iron deal. Where stands that deal now? Is it as bulletproof and cast iron as the Taoiseach said back then?
Oh, very much so. That December, a commitment to avoid a hard border still very much stands. And that's what the British government are saying. What we need to do now is what Mr. Barnier has said, and he's quite right, that we need a greater level of clarity, that we need to be moving now towards written solutions and specific solutions, the detail of which we haven't unfortunately seen yet. Reading Martin Wolf in the Financial Times during the week, he speaks about open civil war in the British cabinet. And yes, there are divisions and this issue needs to be resolved, which of course is outside our immediate control. But on the one hand, in the British government, we see people like Philip Hammond and Amber Rudd and David Lidington, talking about the need to ensure that the UK has as close as possible a trading relationship with the European Union, which broadly coincides with the Irish position. And on the other hand, then we've got the Brexiteers, we've got Johnson, we've got Gove, we've got others, Fox and Davis, who have a different view. And in the middle, with Theresa May as Prime Minister. So we are running out of time. We need to ensure that what was said in December in terms of the regulatory framework is now committed to writing. That's the message from Barnier, and that's what the Irish government has been said. And can I say once again, Justin, that what we're seeing is the European Union, the 27 EU member states, in line with exactly the Irish position.
Okay.
We've got it in the common travel area, we've got it in the matter of the peace process, we have it in the matter of the hard border. It's up to the British now to produce or reduce their commitments to writing.
Patricia McBride, do you have as much faith as Charlie Flanagan does that the British will keep that promise for the bulletproof deal that we got?
I think that they have to, and the reasons for that are very, very simple. It goes back to what we were talking earlier about in terms of dissident Republicans. Any physical border infrastructure is going to create a security nightmare for the British. Who will staff that? Who will fund it? Now, the British are saying, well, you know, if you want a hard border, you put it in. We're not asking for a hard border. You pay for it. Well, actually, that's not the issue. The issue is who's going to actually ensure that there is some sort of control over population movements and over economic, you know, or the movement of goods and services. So the issue that creates is a security one that the British cannot afford. That's the bottom line. So they have to resolve it for that issue.
Daniel McConnell, you were in Austria this week with the Taoiseach. Mm. He was obviously canvassing support for the Irish position there with the new Austrian leader. Where's all this going now?
Yeah, well, Sebastian Kurz, who's now the youngest leader in Europe at just 31 years of age, was very supportive in his language vis-a-vis Ireland. He's someone who actually learnt his English in Bray, County Wicklow, of all places, which I thought was kind of interesting. But he was very supportive of the Irish position that a hard border can't work. And the language from him chimed very closely to the language of the Taoiseach. Now, the Taoiseach, you know, voiced some anger and frustration, I thought, when I asked him actually specifically on the Brexit issue and the kind of the lack of clarity coming from Downing Street. He said, you know, time is very much running out. You know, March 19th is not that long away. And ultimately, you know, we need to see delivery on the commitments made in December. But, you know, given how chaotic things are in Downing Street, I wouldn't be as cast iron and as confident as Minister Flanagan here is beside me.
Okay, and Niall Collins, final word to you on this. I mean, do you think that the Irish government is taking the right approach in supporting that hard line which is being taken by Michel Barnier? You know, should we not be taking a softer approach because we want the best deal possible for Britain, really?
No, we're fully supportive of the Irish government in terms of their stance, and we're absolutely happy also to see the solidarity and the cohesion that the EU27 are demonstrating towards Ireland. And I think Michel Barnier was right to call it the way he did. He's calling out the English in terms of their whole approach to this. I was over there 3 weeks ago in London with my colleagues Stephen Donnelly and Dara O'Brien. We spoke to members of the Labour Party, members of the Conservative Party. We were in number 9 Downing Street where we met Robin Walker. He's the junior minister in the Brexit department. And, you know, they're just all over the place over there. And I think Michel Barnier is right to call them out in relation to that. From our own point of view, I think, you know, we've been putting pressure on Charlie and his colleagues in government. You know, the wait and see approach, I think, isn't going to serve us ultimately well if we have a disorderly Brexit. And there's things like the relaxation of state aid rules and the establishment of an enterprise stabilisation fund, which I've been articulating for within Dáil Éireann. When Intertrade Ireland, for example, tell us that 19 out of 20 firms aren't Brexit ready or haven't done any Brexit planning, we got to get worried.
All right, more to come, no doubt, in the coming days. That's our lot now for today. My thanks to my panel, Minister Charlie Flanagan, Niall Collins, David Cullinan, Patricia McBride and Daniel McConnell. Cormac O'Hara is here next week. Until then, thanks for listening and have a very good afternoon.